Hey, what's happening? It's Ben Bailey-Smith.
And Sasha Bates.
And we're about to launch into more episodes of STB. So while we do some intense and detailed TV watching, I know it's a hard job, someone's got to do it. We thought it only right and fair to answer some of your emails because we've had such an incredible response. You know, I'm always saying, oh, post bag, it's bulging, we got all these things, and you probably think it's nonsense, but we do. And we started whittling it down. And here's the proof. So we're going to get into your thoughts on the show, on the characters we're talking about. So, coming up, someone asks whether analysing a fictional character really means analysing the writer and what it would be like having a werewolf on the couch, plus your suggestions of who you'd like to see in therapy. Welcome to the snappily titled Shrink the Inbox. Here's one, Sash, on the WandaVision episode. Mm-hmm. Great. Great episode.
Yeah.
You were just phenomenal in that. Oh, honestly.
As were you.
I was. You're right. This is from H. Stuart Trossel, who says, hello to Ben, Sasha, and the production team. Just listen to the episode on Wanda. And first of all, my condolences to both of you, Ben and Sasha, for your losses. Mine was fresh and yours was...
not so fresh, but feels it at times.
Thanks, H. He says, I really appreciated this episode and its discussion of the processing and internalization of grief, as I had a death in my family last year. It was not sudden, and I thought I had adjusted to the concept of their passing in advance. But then there are times, just yesterday, during a film, in fact, where I suddenly viscerally remember they're gone, and it knocks me out. Thank you for diving into models of grieving that address that non-linearity. It's very helpful. And I also really loved the discussion of Wanda's grief made manifest in the world of the show. And it reminded me of another character I love, Dr. Walter Bishop, played by John Noble on Fringe. While not actually creating an alternate universe, Walter nonetheless discovers that one exists, and it's one in which he is able to save the person whom he lost in his own timeline. Obviously, this has ramifications. Sorry this got so long, but I really am enjoying listening. A really sweet email to kick off with. Thanks, H. Stuart Trossel.
And he's right when he talked about how it hit him suddenly watching telly, because we are constantly getting new triggers and you don't know what's going to trigger you. It can be a scene on a television show. It can be going into a certain restaurant. It can be hearing a song. You kind of never really fully relax after you've had a big loss because you can be slightly ambushed at any time. But hopefully you get slightly better at managing the ambushes and they don't kind of take the rug out from under you quite so dramatically as in the early days. But yeah, hang on in there, H. Stuart Trossel, and thanks for letting us know.
And again, you know, I'm constantly banging on about great writing, but don't you think like great writing in a movie or a TV show, that's what it will do, whether you like it or not, like not even just about grief, but like it will make you feel something to the point where you want to call a loved one or you think, oh, you know what? I should spend more time with so-and-so.
That gets you on an emotional level.
Exactly, exactly that. Nice one, H. All right, here's another one on Wanda. This is from Sam Gonzalez. Hi, Ben, Sasha, and the STB team. I'm absolutely loving the show. I just listened to Wanda Maximoff episode and thought your sympathetic review of her actions in the show was great. When I watched the show, I was more preoccupied by her grief manifested in the accidental or thoughtless injury to others and honestly missed much sympathy with her situation overall. So I really enjoyed your views. I've got two character suggestions. I grew up as an avid fan of Buffy, the Vampire Slayer, so I'd love to hear your thoughts on her, a young teenage girl with the responsibility of saving the world. Additionally, I'd love to hear you get under the skin of Idris Elba's morally ambiguous Luther.
He's
an interesting character.
He is.
I think they're both interesting shouts. Did you ever watch Buffy back in the day? I never watched it
like from beginning to end. I sort of saw odd episodes here and there. But yeah, I'd quite like to really engage because so many people talk about it.
My sister's obsessed with it. My eldest daughter's watched it all and says it's like superb. And I don't know what it was. It must have been my age at the time.
Yeah, me
just,
too.
Wrong side of whoever it was aimed at. I can't think.
Mm.
All right. Alex Smead in Balfron says, hey, Ben and Sasha, ever since I heard that the podcast was starting, I've had this question in my mind about the premise of the show. I'd be interested to know Sasha's comment on how far we can go in psychologically analysing a fictional character. The psychological models are based, presumably, on research and experimentation with real people, but the characters in the shows discussed are deliberately created by a writer. Does this mean that the characters might show several psychological patterns that are never seen in real life because they are, by virtue of the genre, fictional? Do the writers have to be deliberate in adding psychological elements to the characters? And if not, does that mean we're actually unpacking the psychological makeup of the writer rather than the character in Shrink the Box? I'm finding the show compelling and thoroughly enjoying it. Alex, that is such a like head spinning question, but I really get what you're saying, because I think I had that question in my mind before we even recorded the first episode. But the more I consume content, and I'll let you speak on this in detail, Sash, but I just want to say this. I think there's things that are said and there's things that are unsaid. And you can watch the worst TV show in the world, terribly written, two-dimensional characters, awful performances, shoddily shot, bad sound design. But you could still analyze psychologically, perhaps, where the idea for this is from. Like, have you ever watched something that is not ostensibly about sexism or misogyny, but it's misogynist, and you can't put your finger on why, but you can just, there's a nastiness to the show that isn't implied.
Yeah.
Then you watch another show that's smart enough to have really nasty content around sexism and misogyny, but you can tell the writers know that it's a bad thing.
Yeah.
You know, they're making a point. But then the other side of it for me, just because this is all from a layman's point of view, I think it's fun to speculate. And I think that's the essence of the show, speculating or around this character and what we can take from it. But I mean, Alex is absolutely right. The writer is God here, and they're making the decisions, and they could be completely misguided in their decisions.
We always have to be aware that there is the writer's voice in there, and we are being given a view of the world that comes from the writer's own. Mm. I think maybe the reason why so many of the shows we look at that have endured are really good is because they're American, whether it's more common to have a writer's room where you have more than one writer's viewpoint, which I suppose helps keep it a bit broader, so it's not quite so one person's subconscious letting their own views filter out. Not that I think that's necessarily a bad thing, because I think it can be also quite therapeutic for a writer to explore, and for many
absolutely people, and sometimes specificity is the thing rather than the universal.
Absolutely. So I think there probably is a lot of every writer in every character or every scenario, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, as long as we know that whatever we sort of watch, read, hear is always somebody's, coming via somebody's lens. We pick the shows we do because there is an inherent truthfulness in there.
I was just about to say exactly the same thing.
We recognize these people. They are internally consistent. So even if they do contradictory things, there is still, you can understand where those contradictions have come about from. So I don't think it matters that they're fictional. I mean, being fictional enables us to talk about them in a way that we never could ethically about real people. And there might be some anachronisms in there or some incongruities. But I think most shows that are good have an internal consistency.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the reason that they work so well is because there's a truth in there that we all sort of get, we recognize it.
Yeah.
We recognize a person who's a bit like that, or we think that rings true to me.
Yeah.
And like you're spot on about American writers' rooms. You know, if you've got 6, 7, 8 people there, and one throws out a cod bit of psychology, this happened when he was a kid, so now he's like that. There's 7 people there going, nah, I don't buy that.
Yeah. You could have one fictional character, like, say, I don't know, for instance, Omar Little, who we looked at in The Wire, who has nothing. He's born into poverty, and we speculated from how he is that probably he either had an absent or a neglectful or an abusive parent, and that enables him to learn how to control his emotions and become very calm, cool and collected and plan, not get carried away by temper. Then we saw Shiv Roy, born into absolute wealth and privilege, but similarly neglected and abused and learnt to control herself in the same way that Omar has. So it makes sense. So it doesn't matter what the background is or what their reaction to it is, if it makes sense within the world that they live in.
I can sort of accept that Omar is a murderer who I find warmer presence than, say, Conroy.
Yeah. So Alex talks about psychological models, but I don't really understand what he means by that, because I think each one of us is individual. We can look at theories that you can apply to different people, but that doesn't make them, oh, they are this model, they will act in this way.
To be fair to him, I think that's what he means. I think he means theories that, you know, you have things that we've all heard about and then things that you've taught us on this show.
We've looked at several siblings and we've seen how they've grown up in the same household. They are treated differently by their parents, but there is a similarity there, and yet each one has very different coping mechanisms. I mean, the Roy family siblings, one goes off into addiction, one goes off into sort of delusions of becoming president, one becomes sort of a sexual fetishist who can't grow up. So just because the same thing happens to somebody doesn't mean they are going to respond in the same way.
We saw in Bloodline a very brilliant example of that too, with another set of four siblings, each very, very different, with exactly the same set of parents, all treated differently, all suffering because of it. So guys, I should say, like, our wall of names with the push pins and bits of string, suggestions of characters to do, is stretching down the Shrink the Box corridor now. I mean, it's nearly out on the street, but we still want to hear more ideas. And here's a few suggestions that have come in just recently. Mark Woodruff says, would love to see you dissect Jackson Lamb, Gary Oldman's character from Slow Horses, the unhealthy, sweary, brilliant spy who seemingly never washes and only eats junk food. He's an anti-hero for modern times and part of TV folklore now, surely. That sounds like a good shout. Everybody keeps talking to me about Slow Horses.
I've actually read all of the Jackson Lamb novels. I think it was about eight or nine.
Okay.
Yeah, they are fabulous. And so I was predisposed to not like the series.
Of course, yeah.
But I loved it.
Helen in Leeds has said Marie Finchley from National Treasure and Ted from Line of Duty. What's National Treasure?
Oh, that was the thing with Robbie Coltrane as the paedophile. Yes.
Right, yeah.
Chilling as well.
That did look chilling. Line of Duty, of course, yeah. And Dave Woolin says, I would love to know what you think about Jack Bauer, a character who on the surface is just all about the shouty, whispery carnage, but deep down he has trouble with his past and family trauma, and in the later series, issues with exes and trust. Dave says, keep up the good work. 24, wow. That was one of the first sort of DVD box sets I remember getting, like, obsessed with in a real kind of boy's own way. It was just like, he's solving the thing, he's running and doing the punching. I knew it didn't have the emotional depth that I really craved, but I could just watch it and, like, go out for beers with the boys, and yet another guy would have the bloop bloop bloop, you know, the little sound for his ringtone. I was like, oh, this really is, like, it's that kind of TV. I can't say I ever really stopped to think about Jack's troubled past.
I'm not sure we've got enough to go on, really, to know about his troubled past, because he just was such a man of action.
We have to watch 24 episodes to the side sash, and we've got get through.
But
no, thanks, Dave. So listen, after the break, we discuss what it'd be like to have a werewolf as a client, and a listener finally takes me to task. It's about time, let's be honest. We're going to be back straight after these messages, unless you're a subscriber to The Take, in which case we'll be back straight after a shout out to Catherine Kaywood, DCI John Lufa, and Wendy Bird. And we're back. This one's from Esther Freeman in reference to our Mad Men Don Draper episode. She says, you mentioned that your sister says the past is a different country. I'm afraid this quotation cannot be attributed to her. The past is a different country, in quotes. They do things differently there. close quote, is the opening line of L.P. Hartley's 1935 novel, The Go-Between, the best opening to a novel ever written, in my honest opinion. It was made into a film in 2015 with Jim Broadbent and Leslie Manville. And should you expand into film, it would be worthy of analysis as it's full of emotionally complex moments, including love, loss, adolescence, and class. However, if I was to suggest a character from a TV show, it would have to be Jimmy McGill from Better Call Saul. Never found him that interesting as Saul Goodman in Breaking Bad. I agree, actually, they've dug way more into him. But seeing his metamorphosis from Jimmy to Saul in the spin-off was fascinating. Shrink the Box has become one of the shows I really look forward to popping up into my feed each week, so keep up the good work.
Thanks,
Esther. And in defense of my sister, it's probably the way I must have said it on the pod. It's actually from an essay that she wrote in recognition of exactly this. So yeah, you're spot on, Esther, and so is my sister, and as usual, I am wrong. Yeah, that is interesting what she says about Saul, because I rewatched Breaking Bad for our Walter White episode, and I couldn't wait for the Saul Goodman moments, and I was like, oh, he's more of a sort of comic aside in this, really.
Yeah, you know, he doesn't get developed.
He's like Huggy Bear or something like that. Do you know what I mean? Starsky and Hutch. I also remember thinking when they were going to do a spin-off, I was like, really? With that guy?
Yeah. But he absolutely comes into his own.
Oh my
and
God.
Bob Odenkirk just plays him so well.
Beautifully.
He is phenomenal.
And, you know, Bob in the States is primarily known as a comedian. And,
is he?
Yeah, and an aficionado in comedy. And he was part of this sort of the figurehead and writer on this show, Mr. Show, which never came over here. But, you know, really in that tradition of like knockabout or sometimes surrealist comedy. He's real comedy royalty over there. So he hadn't really done like a massive amount of drama.
Oh my God, I would never have known that.
He was more associated.
Brilliant.
Mainstream wise, he probably would have been more closely associated with things like The Simpsons.
Wow.
You know, he's a big writer on there and a lot of voice stuff. But yeah, he's a proper comedian. So I think even more kudos to him and to Vince Gilligan and the writers on the show, because I think a lot of us expected it to be this explosive, you know, sequel / prequel, you know, whatever, reboot. And actually, it's so patient and joyfully cautious in its storytelling.
It slowly uncovers the layers. And I'm going to confess something, which I'm sure will get a lot of people cross. I prefer it to Breaking Bad.
So do I.
Oh, do you? Okay, good.
But there are even elements to Breaking Bad where I think Vince wasn't sure where the story was going. And
yes.
I think he's actually publicly, you know, spoken about that, and he had to find it. And with Better Call Saul, it just feels like, I know what the fuck I'm doing now.
Yeah.
That the confidence to give you these time leaps and still have mystery and intrigue, the sense of a life lived as well,
and
mistakes made and regrets. It's beautifully observed in Better Call Saul. And I agree with you, Sasha. I think it's the better show. And I don't think that's an insult, really, because they're both great shows.
They are.
So Vince really doesn't have to worry. The man's a genius.
He is.
So, you know, we've had some people sending long lists of characters, like just like 20, 30, just names that they'd like to see in the therapist's chair. And that is a lot of TV for us to watch, but we really do appreciate you taking the time. So here's a few more before we mosey off into the sunset. Chloe Selby says, hello team, I've had a run of ideas for potential subjects for Sasha to analyse that feel a bit obvious, but then I had a thought about a character who really impacted me as a young person, might feel a bit left field. Oh, this is what we like, Chloe, this is what we like. George from Being Human, BBC Three. I'd forgotten about Being Human.
I haven't seen it.
That's great, with Russell Tovey.
Ooh.
Yeah, oh no, look, she references Russell Tovey here, she said, George is a werewolf and struggles with who he becomes by the light of the moon. But with his two friends, who are a vampire and ghost, they wrestle with what it means to really pursue being a person.
Ooh.
It's been such a long time since I watched it. Same, Chloe, same. But I remember that Russell Tovey is something of a genius in the role, agree. And I'd love to hear Ben and Sasha unpick what is going on for him, especially as he has a complicated relationship with his alter ego when he falls for Nina. Who I think is the ghost. It's a good one, I think. Really enjoy him, Shrink the Box. So thanks for all your work.
Mm.
Nice one, Chloe. That is a great left field suggestion. And I'm with you, Chloe. I remember Being Human, and I've mentioned it to friends and they don't know what the hell I'm talking about. They give me the same face that they give me when I start waxing lyrical about 15 stories high. It's just blank. What are you talking about?
I've never heard of 15 stories high.
Brilliant BBC Two or, you know, alternative BBC channel comedies and dramas that just never got the right push. IMO, my friend Sharon Horgan's show, Pulling. Do you remember that? Yeah. Again, just get shunted around. Still, the snooker's on. It'll be on at 11. Mm. You know, next week it's on at 9 o'clock. People just don't know how to follow these shows and then they disappear.
Yeah,
they don't get,
and that was a great
remade.
One. I do remember that one.
Great
it
show.
Was brilliant.
15 Stories High was Sean Locke, much missed Sean Locke's comedy that he wrote and starred in that I think is worthy of a shrinking box, actually. It's him and Benedict Wong sharing a flat. And Sean is this miserly lifeguard at a swimming pool, basically.
Right.
But there's a lot going on in it.
Okay.
Sometimes slightly surreal. It's set in a block of flats in South London, big, tall, high rise. So you get glimpses of these other working class lives quite a bit. And it's one of the last sort of working class comedies that I think I really, really loved.
Mm. You're talking about that. I just had an image of a tower block in East London. It made me think of Chewing Gum, which of course was Michaela Cole's first series before she did The Incredible I May Destroy You, which we talked about a couple of weeks ago. Chewing Gum might be worth us
that
having another look
shot.
At.
She's had a bit of a Vince Gilligan trajectory, hasn't she, as well? Because Chewing Gum was great, but, you know, I mean, wow.
Yeah, it was a hell of a leap from Chewing Gum
I May Destroy You. Yeah. I May Destroy You was so powerful and so disturbing that when I listen back to our I May Destroy You episode, the episode disturbed me.
Yes.
It's like, geez Louise.
Just
like,
remembering.
The tentacles of this show.
Yeah.
Oh, man. You know, I just thought, it being human, if you did have a werewolf as a client, you'd never know. Unless it was like a doorknob moment where he goes, by the way, just as he's leaving and the full moon shines through your
I'd have to be
window.
Very careful when I scheduled their session for. But even if I knew, I wouldn't be able to tell you, Ben, because obviously
confidentiality
is sacrosanct.
Sasha,
so
what are those marks on your arm?
Yeah.
I'm afraid you can't get into it.
No, exactly.
Guys, I'm really worried about Sash. Okay, we have one here from someone who's chosen to be anonymous for good reason. They say, hello there, I'm really enjoying your pod. If you do choose to mention me, please don't say my name as I'm a practicing psychotherapist. Karen, we will not mention it. In addition to the relationships you covered, and very well too, I thought it important to include Don's relationship with Anna Draper, Mad Men, because that seemed to be the only time he had a relationship with a woman where he could be himself, i.e. Dick. It was a true friendship and not an affair of any sort. She's easy to miss. She was the widow of the real Don, an unglamorous but authentic woman. She didn't feature much.
Yeah.
I'll be honest. Thank you very much, Anonymous. I completely forgot about that.
Mm. Well, we only did series one.
Oh, that's why. Okay.
And I think she popped up in season two. Mm. I'm sorry. I'm using series and season interchangeably because I'm bilingual in English and American. I mean, you're absolutely right. It was his only authentic relationship, I think, from memory. But I didn't rewatch season two and I had forgotten about her. But if we get a chance to get onto season two, I'd love to talk more about her. Maybe it was a guilt thing on his part.
Maybe we'll mention it if we ever do Peggy. Quite like to do Peggy.
Oh, yes, Peggy.
She was a great character.
The only woman in Sterling Cooper who was allowed to actually move on from being a receptionist and secretary. She got to actually be an ad woman.
Ad woman. Okay, we've got one more for now. It's Paul from Nottingham, who just says, how about Joshua Lyman from The West Wing?
Josh. Mm. I mean, it's really interesting to think back to West Wing, having just so recently watched Succession, because West Wing shows these people, they are incredibly smart and they've really earned their place in the White House and into power in a way that the Roy kids were just born into a sort of powerful family and don't really have the skills or the talent or haven't had to work at it.
And also, I think another time that might come might be Succession related. I don't know. I don't think we're done with Succession.
No.
That's all I can say at this point. Sash, I always worry when I get excited about all these characters because I just think you've got your actual real life clients.
Yeah, I know.
And then I just keep throwing shitloads of new characters on you like every week. Like, how are you feeling?
Oh, well, no, I love it. I love the excuse to go back and watch these great shows. Yeah. And some seeing them for the first time, thanks to your brilliant suggestions and to our listeners' brilliant suggestions. But yes, of course, my real clients absolutely come first and first. Always will.
Werewolves or otherwise.
Well, werewolves or otherwise, I will never tell. But I love the fictional ones because I can talk about the fictional ones.
And have fun. You know?
And have fun.
You can even laugh at them.
I can even laugh at them in a way that I would never do with my real clients. Yeah, but I think when they're fictional, they're fair game, really. We can be play a bit more free and loose with our attitudes and opinions. Yeah. Don't have to be quite so invested in the unconditional positive regard, which is one of the main tenets of humanistic psychotherapy, which is what, you know, as a therapist, I bring to all my clients, unconditional positive regard. Whatever they tell me, whatever they do, whatever they say, I keep in mind that that it's all valid.
Mm.
And I don't have to do that with the fictional ones. I'm free to get cross. Well, I give a shit, but I'm free to be cross or to dislike them.
No,
or I don't have to be quite so understanding.
Pass opinion on them and all
pass
of that.
Opinion, exactly.
Yeah.
So it is different. It is different.
It is different. So despite our increasingly bulging post bag, you know, we made our bed. we're gonna enjoy lying in it.
Absolutely.
So thanks, Sash, and thanks to our production team. Production management is Lily Hambly. The assistant producer is Bashak Ayrton. Social media is Jonathan Imieri. The studio engineer is Jay Beal, as is the mix engineer. The senior producer is Selena Ream, and the executive producer is Simon Poole. Thanks, guys.
See you next week.
Yeah, see you then.
Bye.